There was once a little man called Niggle who had a long journey to make. He did not want to go. Indeed, the whole idea was distasteful to him, but he could not get out of it. He knew he would have to start sometime, but he did not hurry with his preparations. He had a number of pictures on hand. Most of them were too large and ambitious for his skill. He was the sort of painter who can paint leaves better than trees. He used to spend a long time on a single leaf, trying to catch its shape and its sheen and the glistening of dewdrops on its edges. Yet he wanted to paint a whole tree with all of its leaves in the same style and all of them different.
Today.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing?
Well, potentially two, but starting with the first, a short story by Tolkien, not part of LOTR, potentially not even related to LOTR, but it's an odd one called Leaf by Niggle.
Okay. All right, so in the scope of this podcast, there's a couple of things that Tolkien wrote outside of Lord of the Rings that are published. We're going to do Leaf by Niggle, and then towards the end, we're going to do Smith of Wotan Major. What we are going to fail to do in this show is Farmer Giles of Ham, which I think we actually should have done way back at the beginning of the Fellowship with the Shire chapters. It would have fit well there, but I didn't think of it until we were done with that. then, I really wanted to do Letters of Father Christmas at some point. Not so much with Clifford, but I don't know, maybe like younger kids or something. But it doesn't look like we're going to get to that one, but highly enjoyable. Then there was another episode. Oh, we should do something on fairy stories, but we're not going to. So anyways, those are the three we're not going to do. This is one of the ones that we are going to do, and this is potentially my favorite of his non-mythology writing. There's the famous Tolkien line, "I cordially dislike allegory in all its manifestations, and always have done so since I grew old and wary enough to detect its presence. I much prefer history, true or feigned, with its various applicability to thought and experience of readers." Okay, so Clifford, having read this story, does this quote hold up?
I don't think it does at all.
No, it definitely doesn't.
Okay, or at the very least, it feels like semantics. Like maybe Tolkien dislikes allegory, but he's employing it by another name or something like that.
So we've talked about this before. When he writes this story specifically, it's probably around the time that he was writing Book 5 of Lord of the Rings, which is what we just finished recording. And so what he really hated was all sorts of the allegory ideas that people were throwing around with Lord of the Rings. And that one I get. It's like, you know, we've had a whole episode. I think when we did the foreword to Lord of the Rings, we kind of just highlighted that as like the main thing. Like, okay, he hates the allegories to that. He likes the applicability, as that quote still said.
In other words, maybe another way to frame that, because it's kind of confusing to wrap your head around the allegory thing. I feel like with the Lord of the Rings thing, probably at the time, people were like, "Oh, you know, is Sauron supposed to be, whatever, Hitler or something in World War II,
and the atomic bomb,
right? You know? Or some comparison to current events like that? Is this like a Wizard of Oz situation,
right?
And he's saying emphatically no,
right?
But this is like this alternative mythology or history that he's created, which might have like useful lessons for the modern day, just as an old myth might have useful lessons for the modern day.
Right, right. Whereas, so now, but now we get to this story, Leaf by Niggle. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, the whole thing's an allegory. I mean, it's layers and layers of stuff going on. And we've already covered in the show, too, when we did the Beowulf special, Tolkien has used allegory before beyond just this story. Mm-hmm. And it's really good whenever he does it. Because he doesn't just go kind of vague, kind of like grasp at straws or anything like that. He goes full. I want one-to-one correspondence. Like you should be able to graph this on like a XY chart. You know, mm-hmm. like you should be able to say exactly what's what. And so when he does, that's part of what makes whatever he does in allegory. That's what makes it really good. Is partially that, and then he tells the clever story within it anyways that's interesting in itself. So with that said, feelings about this without giving anything away.
One feeling to add on to the allegory thing is it feels so allegorical. It almost felt like a riddle. Like you just know that it has to be referencing something specific that's not stated in the story, but it gets a little tricky to figure out what it is. And so by the end of it, I felt like I was solving a prolonged version of one of the riddles out of The Hobbit.
Oh, really?
Where you've got like a little story and you can see like, you think you've got all it put together and then you're not sure. But it sounds vaguely nostalgic.
Okay.
Kind of, I get the sense of British countryside. It sounds a little bit dreamlike. Like the way time passes is a little bit confusing.
Oh, yeah.
but then by the end of it, we get some new characters that threw me for a loop. So I was frankly stumped by the end.
Okay. Interesting.
But it had a satisfying feel. Like it felt like it was like a pleasant story.
Yeah, okay, so full disclosure, Clifford had basically went in pretty damn cold. Mm-hmm. I basically told
you. It's my job here. Yeah.
I basically told you, hey, it's an allegory. And then I think it's 1.5 allegories. Whatever that means, because I can't fully describe that. Whereas myself, I had read it before and had picked up some of it myself, I think. And then when I was originally doing outlines for this whole show, which was literally years ago at this point, I had read people's notes on it, and so I picked that up and I guess remembered it. But anyways, I went into this kind of cold-ish, and then I recognized all the details because of what I remembered reading. But I didn't reference anything for this specifically tonight. Like, I had notes for it, and it's just accurate. I think I got enough of this. We're just going to go at it. It'll be kind of fun if there's something that stumps us, actually. Because I think I got the main stuff. So we should be good to go. With that, you ready to start this?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so Hobbit-esque beginning. You want to take it, first couple lines?
There was once a little man called Niggle who had a long journey to make. He did not want to go. Indeed, the whole idea was distasteful to him, but he could not get out of it. He knew he would have to start sometime, but he did not hurry with his preparations.
Okay, so we'll talk about his name in a little bit. Obviously, we got to address somebody that's named Niggle, and then there's some sort of journey, so that sounds unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did remind me strongly of The Hobbit at the beginning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this Niggle guy, though, anyways, we're told the next couple, we're not going to read the whole thing, obviously, but, well, actually, that's not obvious with us. Anyways, we're choosing not to read the whole thing tonight. Niggle, we're told, is a busy man and a painter, but everything he has to do distracts him from his painting, even though he does all the distracting chores fairly well, actually. Mm-hmm. And it still pisses him off, though, that he doesn't have time for his painting. So there's this one guy in particular, his neighbor, Mr. Parrish, who has a lame leg, and he asks him to do a lot of odd jobs. Occasionally, he even helped other people from further off if they came and asked him to. Also, now and again, he remembered his journey and began to pack a few things in an ineffectual way. At such times, he did not paint very much. Then we come to some crucial details. You want to take this part?
He had a number of pictures on hand. Most of them were too large and ambitious for his skill. He was the sort of painter who could paint leaves better than trees. He used to spend a long time on a single leaf, trying to catch its shape and its sheen, and the glistening of dewdrops on its edges. Yet he wanted to paint a whole tree with all of its leaves in the same style, and all of them different.
Okay, so now with that, where did he get this name Niggle from?
I'm perplexed.
Oh, it's really?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. I thought this was the easy part.
Oh, no. I was totally confused why. I mean, it sounds like a little bit, it sounds like a children's story in a way.
Yeah.
Kind of in a way that the start of The Hobbit does or something.
What do you think of when you think of the word niggle?
Wiggle.
Okay, wiggle. What else?
I don't know.
All right. Well, what I thought was kind of like, gnaw isn't quite right, but like some sort of like itch, pester, fidget. Okay. Fidget, really important. Play with, you know. Get sucked, like this says, get sucked into the details of something. Like, I'll just mess around trying to make this little leaf perfect, even though I got this whole picture to do or something, you know?
Yeah, kind of like nag, like some little faint nagging.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that is the what he's going for with the name. I think everything I can remember, and then it just makes sense.
Okay.
For now. Okay. All right, so we got this next part. You want to take it or should I?
There was one picture in particular which bothered him. It had begun with a leaf caught in the wind, and it became a tree, and the tree grew, sending out innumerable branches and thrusting out the most fantastic roots. Strange birds came and settled on the twigs and had to be attended to. Then, all around the tree and behind it, through the gaps in the leaves and boughs, a country began to open out, and there were glimpses of a forest marching over the land, and of mountains tipped with snow. Niggle lost interest in his other pictures, or else he took them and tacked them onto the edges of his great picture. Soon the canvas became so large that he had to get a ladder, and he ran up and down it, putting it in a touch here and rubbing out a patch there. When people came to call, he seemed polite enough, though he fiddled a little with the pencils on his desk. He listened to what they said, but underneath he was thinking all the time about his big canvas, in the tall shed that had been built for it out in his garden, on a plot where he had once grown potatoes.
All right, so now it is time to start mapping out what is some of this stuff in here. But any feelings first, though?
This when he starts talking about this particular painting, the story, this is where it takes a fantastical turn. Because at first it's like, okay, this is just a guy out in the countryside. He paints. He's got a neighbor. We hear his feelings a little bit. But now it sounds like the thing that he's painting has almost come to life. Or it sounds like it's got its own... It's animated in some way because he's describing the tree growing and sending out branches and then tending to the birds on the branches. So this is where it's like, is he getting immersed inside the painting? Is this just a peculiar way of describing how he's building out, how he's painting the painting?
Okay. Yeah. All right. So we know the name Niggle. If you had to guess... If this were based off a real person, who would it be based off of?
At this point, it sounds I assumed heavily like Tolkien.
Yes, yeah, autobiographical.
We know already, we've talked about him talking about discovering the story of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, yeah.
Like kind of finding it, and the way he describes Niggle painting this canvas is how I could imagine Tolkien imagining the Lord of the Rings story. So I kind of assumed it's like Tolkien, and he's got this passion, but he keeps having all these random pesky things in life that he's got to take care of that distract him from his true care, which doesn't really make him any money, doesn't get him any food, doesn't take care of his neighbors.
Yeah,
and he's too nice to say no to all these people.
Yeah. Okay. So you're on the right track. So what's the tree then? If we got to like nail something down for all these things, what were we going to say?
The tree, I think, is The Hobbit.
All right, good guess. No, I think the tree is Lord of the Rings.
Oh, okay.
And keep in mind, when he's writing this, he's about where we're at in Lord of the Rings. Maybe a little bit sooner. Maybe much of Return of the King is not written yet. Okay, so keep that in mind. What's the forest?
The forest, I think, is the Silmarillion, the backstory to elves and the world.
The entirety of the mythology.
Okay.
Is what I would guess. Yeah. And then the individual leaves are
the characters in Lord of the Rings.
Oh yeah, okay. You were saying characters. I just said the individual stories, like a Lord of the Rings chapter, but then also how it says he's on the ladder, but then he's running up and down. It's like he's constantly working on different parts of the mythology, stuff from the Silmarillion versus stuff in Lord of the Rings and everything.
And then, Frodo versus Aragorn and all this.
Yeah. And then, so he loses interest in his other pictures. What are these other pictures?
Other short stories that he's worked on in the past that aren't Lord of the Rings specific.
Right. Or any sort of real, like,
right. Or potentially maybe his university work at the time. I don't know if he's teaching then.
Yeah. I also not mapping stuff, but the tree gave me vibes of the Norse Yggdrasil tree.
Yes.
You know, like how it represents the whole universe, and then that's kind of I don't know. I got that vibes too, especially
when it's associated. It is a world unto itself.
All right, and so then, so like we're saying, probably autobiographical, like you're saying, Tolkien had to, this picture's taking him forever. Tolkien with Lord of the Rings takes him 13 years to write this thing. and all of the Silmarillion stuff, he worked at that for 50 years, and none of it was published in his lifetime, right? So, I don't know, there's a sense that when Tolkien was writing this story, he might have feared that he was never going to finish this stuff. Like, he might have been at that sort of point. Mm-hmm. And of course, he just works on this short story instead of... All right, Clifford, we're inserting this here. I have a major... correction.
Ooh, that needs exciting. To be made
to this Leaf by Niggle.
Corrections.
Yeah, exactly. We really don't, but this one is nothing that we said in the specials wrong. It's just intensified by this correction that needs to be said. So I said he published Leaf by Niggle in 1945. That is true. But what I quickly glanced over, it was written in 1938 and 1939.
Mm.
So that means it was written. Yes, he's still talking about Lord of the Rings when he's talking about the tree, but no, he's not on book 5 of Lord of the Rings. He's still, on book 1. Like, they're probably just getting to Rivendell by, 1938, 1939. So, when he said, man, how am I ever going to finish this, all this time and stuff, it's, yeah. Yeah, he really did have a long way to go. And there was parts where he said, there's some good passages and stuff, but on the whole, it's like, I don't know if this is really what I was hoping for. And it's like, that makes sense if you're really actually at the beginning, like he was.
right. He's opened up a lot of boxes, hasn't tied anything up yet.
Absolutely not. And it wouldn't get published until, 1954. So yeah, he was a very long way off at that point. Future looked bleak.
Interesting. Yeah, that does change things a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't think it actually changes too much of anything else that we say in this special. It just, intensifies everything. So just be aware of that. Whenever we say 1945, no, we mean 1939. So just FYI. So the story goes on, and Niggle thinks, at any rate, I shall get this one picture done, my real picture, before I have to go on that wretched journey, he used to say. Yet he was beginning to see he could not put off his start indefinitely. The picture would have to stop just growing and get finished.
This part, I thought, was like, what is this journey? Because it doesn't sound specific. Like, he's been putting it off, and he hasn't really been packing for it. It doesn't sound like a vacation or a trip like we would think of a journey. So my first thought is like, okay, if it's Tolkien, is it about going off to war or something? But it seems too late.
Mm.
This seems like later in life. I know that he fought in World War I well before he started, or I assume before he's working on this part of Lord of the Rings that we're describing.
I don't want to reveal it yet. I want to keep going with it.
Okay.
But Yeah. So, all right. So he goes to look at the picture, and he wished he had some sort of friend to give him approval or encouragement to keep working on it. Or even, he even basically says like a stipend to keep going on it, you know? So I guess, you know, C.S. Lewis, his son, Christopher, the Inklings, lots of them were reading this kind of stuff, but I guess maybe that wasn't enough at some times, or yeah, he's almost implying that he wished he could have been funded for this. Not like he was actually asking for it, just wishing it, you know? But Nigel knows he needs to concentrate and really focus and roll up his sleeves and finish this thing. But the interruptions keep coming. There's jury duty, sick friend, Mr. Parrish is laid up, visitors keep coming. What does it say there?
There were many things that he had not the face to say no to, whether he thought them duties or not. And there were some things he was compelled to do, whatever he thought. Some of his visitors hinted that his garden was rather neglected and that he might get a visit from an inspector. Very few of them knew about his picture, of course, but if they had known, it would not have made much difference. I doubt if they would have thought that it mattered much. I dare say it was not really a very good picture, though it may have had some good passages. The tree, at any rate, was curious, quite unique in its way. So was Nigel, though he was also a very ordinary and rather silly little man.
Okay, so jury duty and a sick friend are too hard to know to get specific about, but who is Mr. Parrish?
I don't know. I would assume somebody in Tolkien's life, close to him, that keeps nagging him to do things that he cares about in a perverse way, but you know, is kind of annoyed by.
I don't know if it's perverse, if that's a hint.
Maybe some colleague, teaching colleague.
Yeah, I think it's a whole Oxford department that he works for.
Okay.
So it's his
kind
real
of
job.
kind of whining, but he does a lot of work for them.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, and then who are the visitors? This can be vague, but I think I got like, I don't know, I gave at least a good guess, but
the visitors I could imagine are maybe visiting family or visiting friends, like actual visitors.
Yeah, I thought it was students at office hours.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
He references sometimes visiting the town to have tea with the visitors. And expecting them to have tea, but then when they show up at his door, he's taken aback. So maybe, I don't know. Yeah, okay, that makes sense to the students.
Right. Well, and so, I mean, you know, if you think about it too, I remember, like, in college, how awkwardly timed and spaced all the classes were, you know, and how chunked up your breaks become. Mm-hmm. And that's like the worst thing in the world for writing. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, if you're going to write something, everybody just wants, let me block off 4 hours. Don't disturb me. Let me just get at it. You know, like everybody talks about the muse, and it's like, I don't know if that really existed, it would be for writing. Mm-hmm. That's gotta be the number one thing, right? It's like, you can't just crank it out. Sometimes it's like, it does have to come to you, and you got to set the right conditions, you know? And it's like, all right, university, not conducive to that.
Uh-huh.
That's what I think his garden is too. I think it's the university projects and papers and essays and stuff, you know, like think like his Beowulf stuff that he did,
which he actually has to do to take care of himself in a way, but he doesn't really want to do it compared to his picture.
Right. And then inspector, I guess, might just be somebody at the university that overlooks this, because the inspector is the one that in this story that I think would check the garden and make sure the house looks all in order or something. Mm-hmm. I don't quite know who the inspector is, but
I feel like
we'll
it could
detail.
Be some more vague, like modern bureaucracy of some sort.
Yeah.
Like, between the university and the general, like, rules of life, taxes, whatever, upkeeping his house.
Or maybe not like, even a, yeah. Or maybe not even a bureaucrat, but a, social norm. Like,
you
gotta have a respectable living, you know, you gotta take care of your garden, you gotta take care of your house. And by garden, it can mean your physical garden, or it could mean, you know, do your work at work.
Right.
I mean, you're paid to do this, and this. So, yeah. Let's see. Okay.
Yeah. I could imagine the British being a little bit judgy about if you have a messy garden or messy hair or a messy suit or something. And
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I think the only other crucial detail from this passage was none of these people know about his picture, so nobody knows about his mythology, right? And they probably don't care about it at all, even if they do. Is at least how he feels or something. But because I think the handful of people that knew about it, they loved it. So,
But he's also, you know, we presumably, since we're assuming it's autobiographical, Tolkien tends to be, I think, very humble.
Like, yeah.
Calling himself an ordinary and silly little man.
Right, right. Well, so it goes on here. It says, at length, Nigel's time became really precious. His acquaintances in the distant town began to remember that the little man had to go make a troublesome journey. So, now, what do you think this journey is?
So, as I was saying earlier, at first I thought it's like literally going off to war or something. But it seemed like, this seems like kind of the writing of an old man. And so I felt like, nah, not going out to war. Is it some other obligation in his life that's more of a full-time commitment? Like something relating to his family? Does he have to move? And I just couldn't figure it out. But then later in the story, this might be an oddball one, but I was wondering if it has to do something with his death.
Yeah, it's definitely his death.
Okay. All right. Well, easy enough. That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like in the next paragraph, it says autumn. Uh-huh. That's like always metaphorical of some sort of ending, you know? And like, this is the one troublesome journey that basically everybody would have to make. Yeah. So.
It's peculiar then because he's talking about preparing for it, but he doesn't really want to prepare for it all that much.
Well, I think that's like having a will and your affairs in order.
I guess so. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see. What did he say here? He says, by his reckoning, he just barely has time, enough time to finish off this picture. And at that, it'll be shabbily done. So again, like this is 1945. So LOTR wasn't finished. He's already been working on it for 8 years. He'd finish it by 1950, but it wouldn't get published until 1954. So I don't know. He really could feel the despair of it. And, I think he would understand life's precious, you know, your time's precious because you don't know when it's going to go. So, let's see. But his neighbor Parrish shows up again. What does he say?
Still, Nigel, did not like the man very much, partly because he was so often in trouble and in need of help, and also because he did not care about painting, but was very critical about gardening. When Parrish looked at Nigel's garden, which was often, he saw mostly weeds. And when he looked at Nigel's pictures, which was seldom, he saw only green and gray patches and black lines, which seemed to him nonsensical.
Yeah, okay, so Parrish always pointed out the weeds, never commented on the picture, and Parrish thought he was doing a kindness for that. So how do we think this fits in?
If Parrish is kind of his fellow professor's Oxford department, something like that,
yeah,
you know, you could imagine a fellow professor strolling into his office and saying, "Hey, you know, your papers are on the floor. You want me to grab that for you or something?" Or
when you're gonna finish it up, you know?
Yeah, not taking any time to offer to read a story or something like that.
Right, right. Help with the weeds and perhaps praise the pictures would have been better, is what the story says on that.
Mm-hmm.
So Parrish came over to ask Nigel. He's the only one around. Go into town to fetch the doctor to pick up his sick wife laid up in bed and the builders. Let me see. What does it say?
So Parrish is kind of like, hey, you know, hey, neighbor, lend me a hand as you always do. I'm really in a tough situation. My roof's leaking and my wife's sick. I need a doctor, but I can't leave. But I need the builders. They're not working today. Just this like this laundry list of conundrums that Parrish has got himself into.
Right. So what does Nigel, or so what does Parrish ask Nigel to do this time?
He asks Nigel to go into town to grab a doctor for Parrish's wife who's sick and to get the builders to come fix Parrish's roof.
Right. Okay. And so
I think also, if I picked up on this correctly, Parrish seems to be, he's like, if only we had some boards and canvas sitting around to prepare my roof. And he kind of eyes
Right.
Nigel's painting as though it's just a source of raw material, but he doesn't say too much about it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So Nigel knows Parrish has the lame leg. So Nigel goes into town on his bicycle because either out of compassion for Parrish and his wife, or because he knows it's the right thing to do, or both, even though it's clearly going to come at a cost to finishing his picture, and he's pretty upset about it to himself.
Mm-hmm.
He's thinking about this painting the whole ride into town, even though it's pouring buckets of rain. He finds the doctor, leaves a note with the builder. Niggle himself gets sick riding home through the rain, and the doctor shows up the next day and has to care not just for the wife, but Niggle himself as well. And Niggle ends up getting sicker than the wife ever was, okay?
Mm.
Builder never comes. Wind messes with Niggle's roof as well, and everything starts to leak and makes Parrish's leg ache worse. At the end of the week or so, Niggle tottered out to his shed again. He tried to climb the ladder, but it made his head giddy. He sat and looked at the picture, but there was no patterns of leaves or visions of the mountains in his mind that day. He could have painted a far-off view of a sandy desert, but he had not the energy. So, what do you think?
This seems like... So, maybe he gets asked to do some sizable task for the university. I don't know what this might be, but some work, and somehow associated with that, I think he gets sick in real life, where he has like an accident and he's kind of laid up for a while. It prevents him from working on his painting, or aka Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I feel like it might have been like a business trip or something, but I don't think we're going to get, at least I'm not going to get what exactly this was. But
yeah, yeah.
Like, I know he had to go on some business trips occasionally.
But... Okay.
To like Belgium, universities there, Scotland or Ireland and stuff. Then again, I don't know. Those might have been kind of fun. But yeah, probably hinders him from doing all this stuff. And like the point is, it's like at this point, yes, this is an autobiographical story, but now we're going beyond. If he's saying like his time's really, really, really precious, it's like, all right, in 1945, I mean, he was in his 40s, 50s. So it wasn't like, I mean, I don't know. Every time's precious, but it wasn't, you know, relative.
Right.
But so at this point in the story, just for the story purposes, Niggle's really running out of time to finish this picture, right? There's days where he doesn't have energy to work on it, and that's unbelievably costly, right? The next day, he felt a good deal better. He climbed the ladder and began to paint. He had just begun to get into it again when there came a knock on the door.
"Damn," said Niggle. But he might just as well have said, "Come in," politely, for the door opened all the same. This time, a very tall man came in, a total stranger. "This is a private studio," said Niggle. "I am busy. Go away."
"I am an inspector of houses," said the man, holding up his appointment card so that Niggle on his ladder could see it.
"Oh," he said.
"Your neighbor's house is not satisfactory at all," said the inspector.
"I know," said Niggle. "I took a note to the builders a long time ago, but they have never come. Then I have been ill."
"I see," said the inspector, "but you are not ill now."
"But I'm not a builder. Parrish ought to make a complaint to the town council and get help from the emergency service."
"They are busy with worse damages than up here," said the inspector. "There has been a flood in the valley and many families are homeless. You should have helped your neighbor to make temporary repairs and prevent the damage from getting more costly to mend than necessary. This is the law. There is plenty of material here. Canvas, wood, waterproof paint." That reminded me too. 1945, where are all the resources going
to the war?
You know, so yeah, it's like, yeah. Oh, I don't know.
And the entire social messaging is like everyone has to make their sacrifices for the war effort, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's possible he's getting social pressure or something at the time for devoting too much time and energy to a creative project that's not serving. Yeah. The kind of national duty or something like that.
Yeah, but then what you got to remember too is like this story said it and then it's true in real life. Most people did not know about this mythology. I guess they knew about The Hobbit, but and then like nobody really seemed to care. None of the professors seemed to comment on it to Tolkien, even though it like had reasonable success. But this is probably more so Tolkien himself feeling guilty for indulging such a time-consuming hobby, you know, whether that's painting in this story, but it's working on the mythology in real life. Anyways, to repeat what the specter said and then keep going with this. "You should have helped your neighbor to make temporary repairs and prevent the damage from getting more costly to amend than necessary. That is the law. There are plenty of material here. Canvas, wood, waterproof paint."
"Where?" asked Niggle indignantly.
There, said the inspector, pointing to the picture.
My picture, exclaimed Niggle.
I dare say it is, said the inspector, but houses come first. That is the law.
But I can't, Niggle said no more. For at that moment, another man came in, very much like the inspector he was, almost his double, tall, dressed all in black.
Come along, he said. I am the driver. Niggle stumbled down the ladder. His fever seemed to have come on again, and his head was swimming. He felt cold all over.
Driver? Driver, he chattered. Driver of what?
You and your carriage, said the man. The carriage was ordered long ago. It has come at last. It is waiting. You start today on your journey, you know. Now there, said the inspector. You have to go, but it is a bad way to start your journey, leaving your jobs undone. Still, we can at least make some use of the canvas now.
Oh, dear, said poor Niggle, beginning to weep, and it's not even finished.
Not finished, said the driver. Well, it's finished with, as far as you're concerned, at any rate. Come along.
Niggle went quite quietly. The driver gave him no time to pack, saying that he ought to have done that before, and they would miss the train.
All right, so who's the driver?
Death?
Yeah, it's like some sort of Undertaker, Grim Reaper, I don't know, something like that. Yeah, is what I would say. So Niggle's dying, not packed. He doesn't have his affairs in order. Picture is not done. Alas. So the story's getting dark.
And the inspector, presumably bureaucracy and or social norms, is saying, like, what have you been up to? Your affairs aren't in the right place for you to be leaving now, but you're leaving anyways.
Right.
And looks like we're going to have to sacrifice your creation for the general good.
Yeah. Doesn't matter if it was undone. Even if it was done, we're going to put this stuff to work. Mm-hmm. Good work. So they bundle him into a compartment on the train. It sounded a lot like a coffin and being buried in the ground. if you know that this is death, it's like, oh, okay, yes, this is the coffin in the ground. You know, the allegory of this stuff, right? Niggle gets off the train, forgetting his luggage, and he is sent to a workhouse infirmary.
It was more like being in a prison than in a hospital. He had to work hard at stated hours, at digging, carpentry, and painting bare boards, all one plain color. He was never allowed to outside, and the windows all looked inwards. They kept him in the dark for hours at a stretch. To do some thinking, they said. He lost count of time. He did not even begin to feel better, not if it could be judged by whether he felt any pleasure in doing anything. He did not even in getting into bed.
Okay, so thoughts about this? This is probably where you start to get in real uncharted territory with the allegory.
Definitely. Okay. It's a little perplexed. It takes a real, like, sounds like some Industrial Revolution horror story, like, in a big, a setting that can't have existed pre-Industrial Revolution is one way to look at it.
Yeah.
Like, whether it's a prison or a hospital or a sweatshop, it's not really clear, but he's in some building just being asked to do things all the time, no connection to the outside or to other people, and he's become completely alienated.
Yeah, okay, so let's add a couple more details here, and then we'll start breaking this open. So Niggle's there so long that it feels like multiple centuries. that he originally goes from being not at what he didn't do in his past, and he seems to forget his picture even, and starts focusing on just getting the odd jobs done that need fixing at this hospital.
Yeah, it seems like he through sheer repetition, he's kind of being habituated into just being a very efficient worker.
The line here, I think, captures that best. This is, probably he really became rather useful, though no one ever told him so. But that, of course, cannot have been the reason why they kept the poor little man so long. Okay, so he's dead. He died on the train. What is this place?
Some sort of purgatory?
Yes, I assume. Correct. Yeah. Yes, this is purgatory. All right, so purgatory, for anybody that doesn't know, or just to quickly give like a two-minute version of it, it's mostly unique to Catholics. But then you get weird exceptions like C.S. Lewis, who believed it. he might only believe it because he talked to Tolkien, but who knows? Anyways, it's the in-between place. So you're not evil enough that you get sent to hell, but you're not exceptionally holy either. So, like, you know, should you really be going to heaven at least straight away? No, there needs to be something in the middle. And then it's highly debatable, the biblical evidence for this and stuff too. But anyways, it's been like a tenet of Catholic faith for centuries and centuries and centuries, probably all the way back. Because you would pray for dead people, and it's like, that's why you pray for them, because they're in purgatory, and you're praying mm-hmm. that they can make it to heaven. So everyone in purgatory makes it to heaven eventually. But in the name, what's going on? In the name, just think about the name.
Purge.
Yes, purging. So you're
purging of your worldly sins. Feelings.
Sins. Okay. Sins. Yeah. Okay. So typically the thought is it's like fire. So it's no fun. It's like, it sucks. All right.
Mm-hmm.
But it sucks, but you have the assurance that you're making it to heaven. So it's not that bad, versus like hell is always known with fire and stuff too. And it's like, well, that does suck, because you're just there.
Mm-hmm.
So another good analogy I've heard too is like, you're not holy enough to go to heaven, and that's the place where, like, you know, heaven's a place for saints. And it's like, if you're going to be counted among them, you should want to do something as saintly as them too, even though you failed doing it in your life. So it's like, well, this is your time to do it. And it's also, in addition to like the purging kind of painful part of it, the analogy that I think is really good is, if you're in a dark room and somebody turns on the lights, it's completely blinding, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in the dark of, say, like, you know, metaphorically in the dark of like sin or something,
mm-hmm.
then if you go to heaven and, you know, God's light, that's always like an analogy, right? That would be blinding to you and everything. So you have to get adjusted, you know, like your eyes have to take time to adjust and to the whole brightness of it, right? So mm-hmm. that's kind of how you're spending your time in purgatory, is getting used to stuff and getting prepared, right? So yeah, so it's no fun. Spent a lot of time there, and he's basically, well, what's Niggle doing here? Kind of seems like what?
Maybe adjusting to this new life, but it also seems like he's being. I frankly can't tell. I can't tell if things are being done to him or if he's doing things himself. It feels very passive.
So I think he's spending a lot of time doing everything he neglected in life.
Okay.
It's like that's
taking care of his house, garden, yeah. All that.
How exactly okay. purgatory works, like, nobody really knows at all,
right.
but there's have written, so I mean, this is Tolkien's attempt to write what he thinks it would kind of be like based on everything he knows, you know, and uh-huh. so he does it in this creative story. So yeah, some people have said, like, oh, you're going to see all your sins in purgatory. And it's like, yeah, it sucks. But and then you got to make up for them too, right, somehow. So, yeah. Last thing, though, there was a mysterious they going on. They said the reason why they kept the poor little man so long, he didn't understand that, or nobody cared or asked, but there's a they, you know. So just FYI. You want to take this next chunk?
Yeah.
Actually, what do you have thoughts on that? What do you think of all that? Buy it? Like it? Interesting?
I'll hold my tongue until we get okay. a little bit further. I'm a little perplexed at this moment.
Yeah, okay. You want to take the next part?
At any rate, poor Niggle got no pleasure out of life, not what he had been used to call pleasure. He was certainly not amused, but it could not be denied that he had begun to have a feeling of, well, satisfaction, bread rather than jam. Could take up a task the moment one bell rang and lay it aside promptly the moment the next one went, all tidy and ready to be continued at the right time. He got through quite a lot in a day now. He finished small things off neatly. He had no time of his own, except alone in his bed cell, and yet he was becoming master of his time. He began to know just what he could do with it.
Okay, so what's going on?
This to me sounds like he's become a great, you know, productive capitalist worker, basically.
Oh, I thought it was like, no, he mastered the time management skills that he did not have in life.
Yes, definitely. That's a much more positive way to put what I just said.
I think, you know, Tolkien, it's autobiographical, and he's being a little hard on himself because the university schedule.
I think he's being hard on himself, but maybe also a little critical of what's being valued in his time.
Well, I thought it was more at the university, like, okay, this schedule's not conducive for anybody. Uh-huh. But then I think he's critical of himself. Like, I did waste time beyond that too.
Okay. You know? Okay.
That's what I was kind of picking up. And now he's mastering that here. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I don't know. You seem to think something different. Maybe.
Well, I can't. Maybe I'm reading it with too much of a 2022 lens, but it definitely sounds like he's pushing aside all this creative energy that he had before. He was like the disheveled creative type beforehand. Now he's like, he sacrificed all this creative time to work on his own projects. And now he's just really, you know, kind of strict and to a T. He responds to all these bells going off, takes care of all the tasks. And the only time he's got to himself is in his bed cell, which is like this little, you know, coffin-like compartment. So it feels like a little bit sad. Like he's becoming officially better and more productive, but like something got lost along the way is what I read into it.
So, well, all right, let me read this detail too, because I'll follow on to that a little bit too. Then suddenly they changed all his hours. They hardly let him go to bed at all. They took him off carpentry altogether and kept him at plane digging day after day. He took it fairly well. It was a long while before he even began to grope in the back of his mind for the curses that he had practically forgotten. All right. So what I thought too, because I had just been reading this week, or audiobooking, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which is the Solzhenitsyn. It's short for him. It's like One Day in the Life of a Prisoner in a Russian Gulag or Soviet Gulag.
Mm-hmm.
And like it just goes through the whole day and it's like, oh man, that kind of sounds like that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. But, so, yeah, that's how I felt. It's like it went from being like, okay, he sacrificed his creative time for some good, hard, productive stuff. And then they just turn up the notch for him. And now he's stuck with just a brutal task endlessly. And it sounds pretty bad at this point.
Well, I think that's the thing. I don't know. I would just interpret it, if we're going with the purgatory thing, it's like, yeah, purgatory is not fun. Like some people think of it as a waiting room. And it's like, no, it's not just a waiting room. Like it's hard uh-huh. work, you know? Uh-huh. That would be the only way to kind of explain it there, but yeah. After he could dig no more, the doctors look at him and he declares that he's got to rest in complete darkness, which almost sounded like solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. But laying in the dark himself, let's get into it here.
Now he heard voices, not voices that he had ever heard before. There seemed to be a medical board, or perhaps a court of inquiry, going on close at hand in an adjoining room with the door open, possibly, though he could not see any light. Now, the Niggle case, a voice, a severe voice, more severe than the doctor's.
What's the matter with him? Said a second voice, a voice that you might have called gentle. Though it was not soft, it was a voice of authority, and sounded at once hopeful and sad. Whatever is the matter with Niggle? His heart is in the right place.
Yes, but it did not function properly, said the first voice, and his head was not screwed on tight enough. He hardly ever thought at all. Look at the time he wasted, not even amusing himself. He never got ready for his journey. He was moderately well off, and yet he arrived here almost destitute and had to be put in the pauper's wing. A bad case, I am afraid. I think he should stay some time yet.
It would do him no harm, perhaps, said the second voice. But, of course, he is only a little man. He was never meant to be anything very much, and he was never very strong. Let us look at the records. Yes, there are some favorable points, you know.
Perhaps, said the first voice, but very few that will really bear examination.
Well, said the second voice, there are these. He was a painter by nature, in a minor way, of course. Still, a leaf by Niggle has a charm of its own. He took a great deal of pain with leaves, just for their own sake, but he never thought that that made him important. There is no note in the records of his pretending, even to himself, that it excused his neglect of things ordered by law.
Then he should not have neglected so many, said the first voice.
All the same, he did answer a good many calls.
A small percentage, mostly of the easier sort, and he called those interruptions. The records are full of the word, together with a lot of complaints and silly imprecations.
True, but they look like interruptions to him, of course, poor little man. And there is this. He never expected any return, as so many of his sort call it. There is the Parrish case, the one that came in later. He was Niggle's neighbor, never did a stroke for him, and seldom showed any gratitude at all. But there is no note in the records that Niggle expected Parrish's gratitude. He does not seem to have thought about it.
Yes, that is a point, said the first voice, but rather small. I think you will find Niggle often merely forgot. Things he had to do for Parrish he put out of his mind as a nuisance he had done with.
Still, there is this last report, said the second voice, that wet bicycle ride. I rather lay stress on that. It seems plain that this was a genuine sacrifice. Niggle guessed that he was throwing away his last chance at his picture. And he guessed, too, that Parrish was worrying unnecessarily.
I think you put it too strongly, said the first voice. But you have the last word. It is your task, of course, to put the best interpretation on the facts. Sometimes they will bear it. What do you propose?
I think it is a case for a little gentle treatment now, said the second voice.
Niggle thought that he had never heard anything so generous as that voice. It made gentle treatment sound like a load of rich gifts and the summons to a king's feast. Then suddenly Niggle felt ashamed. To hear that he was considered a case for gentle treatment overwhelmed him, and he made him blush in the dark. It was like being publicly praised, when you and all the audience knew that the praise was not deserved. Niggle hid his blushes in the rough blanket. Anyways, the voices...
That's good enough. Okay. All right. What's going on?
This is like, this is his judgment, right? Judging whether he can move on from purgatory or not, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, so I think like any story you hear the final judgment or anything, mm-hmm, I think that would happen before you make it to purgatory or not.
Right, right.
But this is definitely some sort of, well, you know, they're doctors supposedly. Like, it sounds like doctors talking about if a patient's well enough, and I guess they're talking about spiritual health at this point, you know. This is to pass them on to heaven or not, right? Theoretically, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're getting that vibe, right? So, who's the second voice and who's the first voice?
Well, kind of a good cop, bad cop type of thing.
Yeah, for sure.
I can't guess who they would be specifically.
Yeah, I don't think you don't need to.
Okay, but. Okay. Anyways, yeah, it's like it's two opinions on his judgment.
Right. Well, so which one's more important? It was kind of sad.
The first voice sounds like they're in charge, but then basically defers to the second voice and says, you're the one who really has all the information, and it's up to you. And the second voice makes the call.
Yeah, it sounded like the first voice is the devil's advocate, and then the second voice is potentially somebody super high up important. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking top, you know, like potentially God himself. I don't really know.
Okay.
Niggle's reaction to that feels like a summons to a king's feast, you know, when he hears about gentle treatment. So summons to a king's feast, there's so many parables that Jesus says about a king sending out messengers to invite him to a feast, mm-hmm, and then people turn down the invitations, and then the king just gets people from the street. It's like, all right, this is like spitting heaven, you know, mm-hmm, like he's trying to say it there. And then what he also says too is he's blushing like this is something that he doesn't deserve, which is also a key to heaven, is that none of us actually deserve to go and nobody earns their way in. God's just so merciful and gracious that he's going to let us in, even though we don't deserve it, which is kind of cool. So it's cool that Tolkien's incorporating all this stuff into his story, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, into this short story that's like actually packs such a punch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anyways, the voices know Niggle's been listening. They ask his thoughts, and immediately he asks how Parrish is doing. And he says that Parrish was a good neighbor and helped him a lot with the potatoes. I think the potatoes might have been his salary.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe work in general. It notes that he noted earlier in the story, there's a brief detail, that the shed, the tall shed, mm-hmm, that contained his painting was built on top of Niggle's potato patch. So presumably he couldn't grow his own potatoes to feed himself. So Parrish, even though he was kind of a thankless asker of helper, did seem to be helping out Niggle with the potatoes.
Yeah. So Niggle wakes up with the sun shining in his room. No more hospital clothes. Good breakfast. Doctors put salve on his wounds. And so salve, how would you even say that? Salve? Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, see, I read it as salve, like salve Regina, or, you know, hail in Latin, you know, mm-hmm. anything to that kind of stuff, right? So anyways, he goes back to the railroad station, and he basically, there's a nice small Thomas the Tank Engine-esque train waiting for him, newly painted, and it's going to give him a ride somewhere. But the train randomly stops in some green fields, and there's no station or anything except a gate and what looks like his bicycle, and it does indeed have Niggle written on it.
Niggle pushed open the gate, jumped on the bicycle, and went bowling downhill in the spring sunshine. Before long, he found that the path on which he had started had disappeared, and the bicycle was rolling along over a marvelous turf. It was green and close, and yet he could see every blade distinctly. He seemed to remember having seen or dreamed of that sweep of grass somewhere or other. The curves of the land were familiar somehow. Yes, the ground was becoming level, as it should, and now, of course, it was beginning to rise again. A great green shadow came between him and the sun. Niggle looked up and fell off his bicycle.
Before him stood the tree. His tree, finished. If you could say that of a tree that was alive, its leaves opening, its branches growing and bending in the wind, that Niggle had so often felt or guessed, and had so often failed to catch. He gazed at the tree, and slowly he lifted his arms and opened them wide. All right. I really love this part. That's pretty cool. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what's going on?
He's left purgatory, it seems. He's okay. Now out in the beautiful sunshine. He's on his bike, and in this kind of dreamland, like he knows what this place is, even though he doesn't know where it is. Feels like he's been there before, and then he ends up in his painting.
So I think he's in heaven at this point.
Right.
Yeah, that's the cool thing. So this is you're getting Tolkien's interpretation of what heaven's going to be like, you know, or taking some sort of stab at something that nobody can really describe or know about. But what immediately popped into my mind was in the book of Revelation, there's a line said by Christ, and it says, "Behold, I make all things new." So by Christ's victory on the cross, you know, and his death, he restarts the world, both, you know, in 30 AD when he died to, or 33 AD when he died to onwards in our age. But then also there's the second coming at the end where everything gets, I don't know, kind of like remade in glorified form. Cause like on Easter Sunday, he comes back in glorified form, like Jesus, like he's still got his wounds and everything, but like he's glorified. And then that's what's going to happen to all of us and the whole earth. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's what's going on here. It's like, how cool is this? It's like, he didn't finish the picture in life, but now the tree's done. All right. I mean, it's, I don't know. It's a cool idea. What do you
mm-hmm.
think?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's like the thing that he dreamed about for so long has been fulfilled. So it's like the redemption or vindication or something of what seemed like a failed task when his life ended.
Yeah. And it says too, all the leaves he had ever labored at were there, as he imagined them, rather than as he had made them. And there were others that had only budded in his mind, and many that might have budded had he had the time to actually focus on it. C.S. Lewis actually does a similar kind of story in the last book of Narnia, if anybody's wondering. But yeah, like Tolkien, it's like, all right, even if I can't finish Lord of the Rings and this whole Middle-earth work in my lifetime, it will be done in heaven, is what he's kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty awesome and cool to see. There's an interesting line there. You want to read that one?
"Some of the most beautiful and the most charismatic, the most perfect examples of the Niggle style were seen to have been produced in collaboration with Mr. Parrish. There was no other way of putting it."
All right. So that was kind of random detail, right?
Yeah. So, but it's like at this point, he's now like all his grievances have been put to bed, and he remembers Parrish really fondly, and Parrish is actually part of this vision. So it's almost like in death, like all things are made better or something like that, are resolved.
All the wrongs are righted, you know? So everything's just the most glorious, better, best version of itself. The story goes on. There's birds in his tree, and there was the forest and mountains there too, behind the tree itself. So it's not, so like the tree was what? What do we say?
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, but then there's the forest and mountains behind it too. So right, that's like kind of the rest of the mythology, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he starts walking around the forest. As he walked away, he discovered an odd thing. The forest, of course, was a distant forest. Yes, he could approach it, even enter it, without its losing that particular charm. He had never before been able to walk in the distance without turning it into mere surroundings. So what do you think that means?
Like, probably in his original creative act, painting, writing, there's stuff, and I feel this way sometimes, there's things that there are at the fringes of your mind that are evocative that you can't fully articulate. And you start to articulate some of them and other ones slip away and they remain just like fleeting emotions or perceptions at the fringes of your,
yeah,
of your mind. And you can't like grab hold of them fully. And now he's able to like immerse inside these things that he only had glimpses of before or saw from a distance.
It's kind of that. I thought it was too, the beginning of the story, it's like he was the kind of guy that focused on the details of one leaf as opposed to the whole big tree or picture and stuff. So now he has the ability, like, oh, I can walk through the forest and I don't need to detail every single thing that I'm seeing. So, like, mm-hmm. I don't have to go in depth with every single story. I can just leave it kind of the big picture, broad strokes, and appreciate that mm-hmm. in itself, you know, without having to go dig deep into it. You know, and just waste my time.
mm-hmm.
What else does he do there? You want to read the next part?
You could go on and on, but not perhaps forever. There were the mountains in the background. They did get nearer, very slowly. They did not seem to belong to the picture, or only as a link to something else, a glimpse through the trees of something different, a further stage, another picture.
All right, so this is where I start to slightly lose explanation powers with another picture,
mm-hmm.
But we can kind of deal with that in a minute. The story goes on here.
Nagel walked about, but he was not merely pottering. He was looking around carefully. The tree was finished, though not finished with just the other way about to what it used to be, he thought. But in the forest, there were a number of inconclusive regions that still needed work and thought. Nothing needed altering any longer. Nothing was wrong as far as it had gone, but it needed continuing up to a definite point. Nagel saw the point precisely in each case. He sat down under a very beautiful distant tree, a variation of the great tree, but quite individual, or it would be with a little more attention, and he considered where to begin work and where to end it, and how much time was required. He could not quite work out his scheme. Of course, he said, what I need is Parrish. There were lots of things about earth, plants, and trees that he knows and I don't. This place cannot be left just as my private park. I need help and advice. I ought to have got it sooner.
He got up and walked to the place where he had decided to begin work. He took off his coat. Then, down in a little sheltered hollow hidden from further view, he saw a man looking round, rather bewildered. He was leaning on his spade, but plainly did not know what to do. Nagel hailed him.
Parrish, he called.
All right, so Nagel / Token kind of needs Oxford's help to cultivate this forest, you know,
mm-hmm.
to its greatest extent, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like saying Parrish knows all about earth, plants, and trees and stuff. I think that really reinforced that Parrish is the university or the department, something, mm-hmm. you know, something very broad and
that knows about the substance of which his painting is made or something.
Yeah, right, right. Because it's like that's where Token's mining all his inspiration for Middle Earth, right? Was through all his university studies and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, well, who would he need to help him? It's Parrish. And then in this story, conveniently, he's there right now. Mm-hmm. Which also means what?
I don't know. Oh, that Parrish died as well. Parrish is also in heaven.
Right, right. So Parrish made it. Okay. So Nagel and Parrish immediately start working together to construct a small house and garden. All right. As they worked together, it became plain that Nagel was now the better of the two at ordering his time and getting things done. Oddly enough, it was Nagel who became most absorbed in building and gardening, while Parrish often wandered about looking at trees and especially at the tree. So, role reversal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nagel has the time management. Parrish can appreciate all the art. As they're working, Parrish confesses that he's not even supposed to be here. He said the second voice said Nagel had asked for him to be here. Niggle's good word basically had got him out a lot sooner, and out, I think, refers to purgatory there. And that might be a case of Tolkien saying, pray for the souls in purgatory because it helps them out. That was my interpretation. Let's see. Niggle points out they both owed it to the second voice for being here to begin with, right? Yeah, so we already covered that. Okay. They went on living and working together. I don't know how long. It is no use denying that at first they occasionally disagreed, especially when they got tired. All right, what did you think of that line?
So, well, this whole idea of them working together feels like it's like a critical thing that Niggle is not, it's not a terminus, it seems like. Like, he didn't stumble into a finished, perfect thing by himself.
Well, it was like already...
The end of his line. It's like it's like this magical fulfillment of everything he dreamed of.
Yes.
And yet there's still a continuation. Like, there's still purpose for him, and there's still connection to these people he cares about.
Okay, so I thought it was slightly weird that there's disagreements, and theoretically, if this is heaven, it seems weird that there's a disagreement, right? You know, you think everything's in perfect harmony, right? But it says they got tired there, which I interpret, and then there's this little paragraph about needing water and stuff. There's physical constraints on them still. Okay. So that's one interesting thing. Then what you're saying, I think this is like the masterstroke of Tolkien, that heaven, it's not the leisurely place in the clouds, you know, where everybody's like listening to harp music and angels playing whatever. In heaven, you have work to do. this is the coolest thing about it, because it's work that you love and it feels good to do, right? You know, like, they're enjoying all every minute of this, right? Like I said, though, they seem to get physically tired. So it's not even just like heaven where, like, your soul's floating around and your body's just in the ground. It's like, no, this is a place where you have your body. Like, this is a real place, physical place. And then in, I think, all of Christian theology, like, the real idea is that, yeah, you might go to heaven, or you go to heaven, or heaven's a place or a state of being, you know, after you die. But then at the end of time, heaven's going to break into earth. And so they must be, I think, at that stage here, because it's like, yeah, they're getting tired, and it's like everything's remade. Like, that's the thing. It's like, at the end of time, second coming, yeah, everything gets remade. And I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does.
I don't know. It's interesting. It's and thought provoking, but yeah, that's this is like heavy. This starts to become like heavy theology and allegorical writing. That's why I kind of said this is like 1.5 allegories, because it's like, all right, this is autobiographical, but then it switches to just Tolkien's laying out the afterlife, like his vision of the afterlife, or version of the afterlife, you know, which is ambitious, to say the least. Let's see. They drink from that magical spring, and it eventually nourishes them to the point where they don't even need to drink it any longer, and Parrish loses his limp. I didn't really know what to make of the spring. You got any ideas?
Some sort of, like, ongoing fulfillment and I group it in mentally with, like, it's like this idea that they're still improving and they're still working. They're not at a terminus of perfection or something.
Yeah. All right, so at this point, Niggle found that he was now beginning to turn his eyes, and more often, towards the mountains. The time came when the house in the hollow, the garden, the grass, the forest, the lake, and all the country was nearly complete in its own proper fashion. The great tree was in full blossom.
"We shall finish this evening," said Parrish one day. "After that, we will go for a really long walk."
Okay. So, like I said, this is where I'm starting to kind of get confused. Because so if this is a physical world, it does make sense to me, I guess, that there would be a finality finish line for, you know, whatever works you're doing.
Right.
You know, like, you could, yeah, you should be able to finish something, right?
Right.
But it's kind of confusing in heaven, because it's like, well, then what happens after that?
Is it linear? Right.
Yeah, because this is eternal, you know, like, this whole place is eternal. So, I don't know, kind of... So that one is a head scratcher for me. But anyways, we could go on with the story and maybe it gets clearer or something. Maybe not. They walk to the edge of their land, and there they meet a shepherd. All right, shepherd, what are we thinking?
Shepherd, I mean, to all the religious references, shepherd, guides the flock. Tons of like Christian symbolism.
Right. Like, so Jesus like refers to himself as like the good shepherd at points and stuff. So it's like, all right, this is Christ, God, something. So yeah, so I think this one's quickly like, yeah, we're just gonna assume this is Jesus, God, something like that. Right. Okay. So he asks them if they want a guide and if they want to go on. Niggle says he does. Parrish says he doesn't because Parrish wants to wait for his wife, who's got to be coming sooner or later at some point. And he wants to show her the house and she can make it even better. Probably more homely is what he says. I assume that's like the womanly touch, you know? Mm-hmm. But
also like
the more bachelor pad.
Presumably she has her, like if she's following the same trajectory of like purgatory,
yeah,
moving on to this garden, heaven, forest, she has her own like linear path thing, like her own set of things that she gets to add to the equation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Parrish then turns to the shepherd and asks the name of this land. "Don't you know," said the man, "it's Niggle's country. It is Niggle's picture, or most of it. A little of it is now Parrish's garden."
"Niggle's picture," said Parrish in astonishment. "What do you think of all this, Niggle? I never knew you were so clever. Why didn't you tell me?"
"He tried to tell you long ago," said the man, "but you would not look. He had only got canvas and paint in those days, and you wanted to mend your roof with them. This is what you and your wife used to call Niggle's nonsense, or that dabbing."
"But it did not look like this then. Not real," said Parrish.
"No, it was only a glimpse then," said the man, "but you might have caught the glimpse if you had ever thought it worthwhile to try." All right, so let's pause there. So what do you think?
So now, is the shepherd referring to the land ahead of them or the land behind? The land behind, right? The forest where they just were.
Yeah, everything they just worked on.
Right. So this is like...
So Parrish wasn't... connected the dots.
This is kind of some bit of vindication for Niggle / Tolkien.
Oh, definitely.
like finally you see why I spent all this time doing this originally.
Right. Well, so Parrish didn't even know this whole time that they were working on Niggle's, you know, well, Tolkien's mythology, basically.
Right.
You know, so the university is now finding this out at its completion. And so it's like, I don't know, this is like, this kind of gets into, is this an aspirational hope of Tolkien that, hey, the university will finally complete, appreciate this stuff once I complete it, you know, after all these years of work? Which, that kind of ties into the question that I've had basically since we started doing this podcast is, does Tolkien make it on the Mount Rushmore of philologists? You know? Mm. All right, so there's a bunch of philologists that we've heard of, most notably the Grimm brothers. I think, like, they're, at least one of them, probably both of them, is solidly on Mount Rushmore.
Okay.
Then I think there's some other Europeans that I can't remember right now. But when I was like thinking about it, reading through Tom Shippey's books specifically, it's like, all right, I don't know. This is Tolkien's on the border for making it based on his academic accomplishments. Okay.
Mm.
So like, you know, so probably not if you only have the academic stuff, because it's like, all right, he did write the single most influential essay on Beowulf, right?
Mm-hmm.
But even as the story was pointing out, he had a messy garden. There was a lot of stuff that was undone that went unpublished, you know, even for his academic work, right? But when you factor in everything, academic work and all this Middle Earth mythology stuff, where, you know, his love of words for, you know, philology, right, is so prevalent throughout all of this, and it was such a massive, like, Lord of the Rings was such a massive success in the history of modern literature, but probably literature period, you know, and it's like showcasing basically his whole field, philology, like that is like a massive thing about it. And not even just philology, but mythology, which is, you know, interwoven in his mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a time when it was actually dying out too, because like over the course of Tolkien's lifetime, like philology is not the same as it was when he started and as it is today, right?
Right.
So despite all that, you know, he writes this super popular books and everything, and it's like, dude, you know, if you factor in Lord of the Rings with his academic work, then I would say, I don't know, in my opinion, it's not that valid, but like I would say, yeah, Tolkien does earn himself on the Mount Rushmore of philology, because it's like he advanced that field greatly without actually doing academic stuff for it, you know. Right, but it's right. Like, but this Lord, writing Lord of the Rings was not nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I that all makes a lot of sense. I guess it's like that's what this is referencing here, is Tolkien acknowledge or trying to make peace with his not immediately recognized contribution that he felt was important.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
One way to put it.
And going back to like how the tree's fully done, it's like, well, in heaven, you know, like, oh, they'll appreciate it there. Mm-hmm, you know? And mm-hmm. It's like, and it'll be because we worked, you know, this was a partnership to even make this possible, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Tolkien also tries to be modest with the next line there, you know, going off the conversation where the shepherd's saying, Paris, you never looked at his stuff. What does Nicol say?
I did not give you much chance, said Nicol. I never tried to explain. I used to call you old earth grubber. But what does it matter? We have lived and worked together now. Things might have been different, but they could not have been better. All the same, I am afraid I shall have to be going on. We shall meet again, I expect. There must be many more things we can do together. Goodbye.
All right, so then at this point, Nigel's story goes on, so let's read that, and then, I don't know, this is the part that slightly confused me, but yeah, why don't you start here?
He shook Parrish's hand warmly, a good, firm, honest hand, it seemed. He turned and looked back for a moment. The blossom on the great tree was shining like flame. All the birds were flying in the air and singing. Then he smiled and nodded to Parrish and went off with the shepherd. He was going to learn about sheep and the high pasturages and look at a wider sky and walk even further and further towards the mountains, always uphill. Beyond that, I cannot guess what became of him. Even little Nigel in his old home could glimpse the mountains far away. And they got into the borders of his picture. But what they are really like and what lies beyond them, only those can say who have climbed them.
Mm. All right. What do you think of this?
This feels like this is like a kind of ultimate fulfillment, finality to the picture that he was in. You know, he sees this beautiful image of it and everything's all good. All the loose ends have been tied up. He's made peace with himself, with Parrish, with his painting, and now he's on this mysterious like uphill journey into the clouds, which feels like this is the resolution to our question, like, is it linear or is there a final thing? It's left as a little bit of a question mark, it seems.
Yeah, it seems like, I don't know, this almost seems like a loose end in Tolkien's allegory itself, because right. It's like, I don't know how to keep describing it, but I think it's just heaven and earth just keep going on, you know, like there's other things to explore beyond mm-hmm. just his own thing. And then I think it's, you know, it's highly significant that he goes off with the shepherd who says is Christ, God or something. So it's mm-hmm. like he's literally walking with God, right. Which is, if you read the Bible and like you kind of get the trajectory of it, it's like Adam walked with God, mm-hmm. Adam fell, ever since then literally the whole goal of the Bible, ultimate goal, is to walk with God. And, you know, now this guy gets to do it and stuff. And other people did too, you know, but it's like, yeah, this is, talk about a good final culmination, fulfillment end, you know, for Nigel, right? But that's not the end of the story. Hey, so I'm adding this in. This is a edit. Or while I was editing, I thought about this. What if to keep the allegory going, the mountains symbolized the true myth of the whole Christian story, and so that was always in the background of Tolkien's story itself, and then Nigel's wandering further and further and deeper into that, as I was kind of pointing out there, as he walks with the shepherd, walks with God. Just a last thought. I thought this one, I don't know, I thought it was worth clipping in this one, but yeah. back to our conversation. So, it briefly goes back to Nigel's passed away in the earthly life, clearly, right? At this point, you would say that's clear?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So, there's still villagers left, and they're debating Nigel's value to the society. And so, one of them explicitly says, he could have been made into a serviceable cock. I should put him and his like to some job that they're fit for, like washing dishes, basically. And if they didn't, I'd have sent them on the journey sooner.
Right. This is kind of where I got more of the like, this is the industrial society right. He's critiquing or something, right?
This
like,
is absolutely, yes, that's what this is. Well, so what, the same guy, what does he go on to say? You want to read that?
Of course, painting has uses, but you couldn't make use of his painting. There is plenty of scope for bold young men not afraid of new ideas and new methods. None for this old-fashioned stuff. Private daydreaming. He could not have designed a telling poster to save his life, always fiddling with leaves and flowers. I asked him why once. He said he thought they were pretty. Can you believe it? He said pretty. What, digestive and genital organs of plants?
Yeah, so that, it's... That's exactly what you're talking about. I mean, So this guy is applied science engineer strictly. No, this is like love of knowledge or anything. It's right. Just put knowledge to work.
Yeah, something like early modernism on top of the Industrial Revolution attitude or something.
He sees plants as just digestive and genital organs. And then even like the painting part, I got the vibes like, oh yeah, you should be able to paint posters like government propaganda posters. Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. That was my thought. But yeah, and I don't know. So I think potentially this was the way universities were going at this time. And even today, like what's king? It's the STEM field. You know, I think any STEM field, you know, has pride of place at a university, which is like in the Middle Ages, that's not true. It was theology. And Tolkien would have loved that. and then nowadays, too, everyone's kind of skeptical about what humanities are teaching or if it's even applicable to get you a job or it's good. Good credentials for a job and everything. And it's like, well, no, humanities is what Tolkien was all about, live for. That's what he wants. You know, universities emphasize with or mm-hmm. emphasize, you know, but I don't know. I think this is like, this reflects a problem that's still around today, mm-hmm. even after Tolkien's dead for about 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on that?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. All right. So it goes on to say Nigel's old canvases, even the big one with the tree, was used to patch up roofs very well.
Uh-huh.
Some didn't even know Nigel ever painted either, like some people in the town. Nigel is quickly forgotten after that, but one corner of the big canvas was for some reason preserved by one of the villagers, and it was one beautiful leaf. And they hung it in the museum, but eventually even the museum burned down. So what'd you think about that?
This is like thankless work, kind of unremembered, totally forgotten, with one exception. But ties it full circle maybe back to the beginning where he's so concerned with the detail of painting every leaf that even the leaf was beautiful by itself, cut off from the rest of the tree and kind of worthy of its own story. But then even that's lost to the lost of time, basically.
Yeah, so to try to map it, I thought maybe the one singular well-done leaf was The Hobbit because that was already in publication by now. Mm. And then I thought the museum was just... some, you know, any sort of preservation thing, but mm-hmm. everything, you know, in this life does come to an end.
Yeah, it's so the museum dust burning to dust down or something.
Yeah, right, end of history kind of thing. Luckily we've already had the happy ending with Nigel and Parrish and the shepherd, and it's like, oh, that's what you can look forward to in heaven. It's like, yeah, maybe you actually walk around with Lord of the Rings characters because they're there in physical form or something, but I don't know. There's the ending of the story, but I think we should just read the ending as the end. So do you have any final thoughts, feelings about the story now that we covered the whole allegory of it?
No, it remains pretty peculiar, but I definitely understand it better after we've explained the allegory a little bit further.
Yeah. Like I said at the beginning, I really liked this story. I thought it was awesome. I thought it was, cool way to incorporate what you think purgatory and heaven's gonna be like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which is just such an ambitious task, but then it's also just I'm glad he took a stab at it. It's influential on me, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I can't be the only one, so I'm glad other people get to experience that. Super happy you took a stab at it. It was fun to read, will mm-hmm. be fun to reread eventually. But with that, should we read the ending here?
Yeah.
All right. It is proving very useful indeed, said the second voice, as a holiday and a refreshment. It is splendid for convalescence. And not only for that, for many it is the best introduction to the mountains. It works wonders in some cases. I am sending more and more there. They seldom have to come back.
No, that is so, said the first voice. I think we shall have to give the region a name. What do you propose?
The porter settled that some time ago, said the second voice. Train for Niggles Parish in the bay. He has shouted that for a long while now. Niggles Parish. I sent a message to both of them to tell them.
What did they say?
They both laughed. The mountains rang with it.
Thanks, y'all.